The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
An official message from Medicare.
A new law is helping me save more money on prescription drug costs. Maybe you can save too. With Medicare's Extra Help program, my premium is zero and my out-of-pocket costs are low. Who should apply? Single people making less than $23,000 a year or married couples who make less than $31,000 a year. Even if you don't think you qualify, it pays to find out. Go to ssa.gov/extra help.
Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Good evening. I'm storyteller Otis Gyre, and I ain't your grandfather. From where I'm from, we don't do bedtime stories. And if that's what you were expecting, you're in the wrong place. If it's terrifying tales you're after, well then, I've got just the thing. Get comfortable. Settle in. Turn off the lights, if you dare. Your night is about to get a whole lot darker. Who needs sleep anyway?
Good evening. You're listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark. Welcome, dear listeners, to Season 15, Episode 2. I'm your host, Otis Gyre, and in this episode, I'll be performing two tales to terrify you, courtesy of authors Dale Thompson and Michael Mann. Tonight we'll hear stories of baleful burrowers and dangerous debauchery. You're listening to the standard edition of tonight's program, which contains the first spine-tingling story. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy an extended version of this and other episodes with twice the terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. Thank you for your support. Now, it's time to take a walk together down the moonlit trail. So lock your doors, turn your lights down low, and settle in. The show is about to begin. Ah! What's that on my arm? Oh, it's just a fly. Shoo, fly, shoo. There we go. You see, most of the time insects are nothing to worry about. Usually they're more scared of us than we are of them. Well, I did say usually, folks, because some people have no worse emotion than that caused by an ant on the ankle, a stink bug in the shoe, or a mantis in the... Well, you get the idea. Tonight, grid yourself and check to make sure your legs are bug-free. because chances are you'll be checking them once or twice during our excursions into Terror. Dale Thompson brings us back to the weird and wonderful world of Dr. Victor Meunier, collector and seeker of the weird and unusual, who is regaling his longtime friends with yet another story of his dangerous exploits. Though he usually confronts more diabolical creations, he finds himself, in this instance, dealing with things with a few more legs than he's used to. Without further ado, I present to you The Mantis and the Doctor. The praying mantis. What a specimen. They are still, they are patient, with what could only be described as a mindfully relaxed nature. They're simply an insect with the power of divination and the fortitude to defend its territory even against the most formidable enemy. Beautiful but deadly. Cannibalistic, yet a spirit guide, a compass for lost, weary, wandering souls. With binocular vision, their compound eyes are suited and created to incapacitate and catch something as small and fast as a fly. Imagine a human with such a monoliform antenna and mandibles. The vertex of the head, some straight, others slightly convex. These insects are like the ancient ones with raptorial prothoracic legs. Each femur bears three series of spines near the claw furrow. It's easy to become attached to these prehistoric creatures with an emotional involvement insomuch as to seek their survival. Marvelously speaking, they have wings, the female wings being the shortest. The wings of the male are much more functional for temporary flight. The mechanics and function are an aerodynamic wonder. The female uses her wings as a threat to menacing hungry predators, holding them at right angles to the body. Yet the male of the species is capable of taking flight with a twitching of the wings, gaining its center of gravity, and launching itself with winged rotation. Dr. Victor Meunier had entered the smoking lounge with a praying mantis attached affectionately to his evening jacket. This was peculiar even for the great doctor, to whom a group of us had attached ourselves to hear of his latest stories of travel, oftentimes meeting with paranormal escapades and unbelievable adventures. We four believed every word. My name's Theodore Fitton. I was in the listenership of Dr. Meunier. I never failed to come when invited to hear of his colorful chronicles. I, along with three others, Peter Blatty, Blake Plantain, and Roger Medford, were regulars at his exclusive private evenings. On this rare occasion, and I say rare because at times, we would go weeks without seeing the doctor due to his extended overseas trips to exotic and faraway places. He'd already met our acquaintance and welcomed us upon entering, give us a brief introduction to whet the curiosity and build intrigue before delving into the details. "I see the impressive and enigmatic perplexities in your eyes. I'm presenting first the visual before I begin my yarn tonight. After my most recent trip, I decided, based upon events that occurred over a two-week period, that these are indeed my favorite insect on the planet. I'm breeding and raising the mantis now. You might wonder why I would take on such a hobby. It's because of supernatural events that the mantis family rescued me from, as well as certain death." There was a small interruption in the doctor's vicissitudes as Miss Walworth, the doctor's sole caretaker and servant in the mansion, entered and quietly removed the praying mantis from the doctor before exiting appropriately through the servant's door in the back of the room. We saw very little of Miss Walworth and assumed it was intentional. The doctor protected certain parts of his life, even from us, whom he called his friends. Dr. Meunier took a seat across from us and asked, "Have you ever heard of a kissing bug or triatomines?" We looked at one another and shook our heads, indicating we had not. "They're nocturnal insects that feed on the blood of mammals, including humans. They use their sharp beaks to puncture skin and suck small amounts of blood, much like a vampire. Not only is this painful for the victim, but in some cases, symptoms of an allergic reaction can occur with added complications. They can release parasites in the victims, and this can lead to further Chagas disease, which may be transferred to people and cause significant health issues, including premature heart disease, intestinal complications, and eventually death. I'm sharing this with you because I've had one hell of a time literally battling creeping and crawling insects straight from the fires below. As you know, my enemies have accumulated through the years, and in recent weeks they've joined forces in what, at the onset, look insurmountable. Yet I was given an early warning through an agent I pay handsomely. I have always said that it does not matter how much wealth and power one has accumulated through their lifetime. When the good Lord calls you home, regardless if you're an aristocrat, royalty, or achieved success as an entrepreneur, your time's up, and no amount of wealth can stop your light from being extinguished. I will say, my light has been very near snuffed on more than one occasion, and what I'm about to share with you is arguably the nearest I have ever been. Miss Walworth returned through the same door she had exited through, pushing a delightful tray of whiskies and cigars. This was a formality we would get out of the way, and then continue through the evening while the doctor elaborated on his story. From the brands of whiskey and the perfectly rolled cigars, this was looking like a night to celebrate. "Thank you, Miss Walworth," Dr. Meunier said. She smiled pleasingly at him, and once again, she excused herself and slipped away. The doctor asked, "Where was I, man?" The doctor often sidetracked himself. I spoke up. "You mentioned life and death and insects." "Oh, thank you, Theodore," he said with a faint chortle, swirled his smoking cigar between his fingers, and continued. "It was 2 weeks ago, today, when I was confronted with a madman. At the time, I did not know him to be clinically insane because he was a colleague, and we shared some of the same interests. He was professionally mad, driven to madness rather than clinically mad. I want to die before I have to see another bug." That's the message that my friend sent to me, which drew me from my dwelling with extreme urgency to the coastal town of Bowes Castle in the southwest of England, northern Cornwall. There's a village there of whitewashed cottages and a supposed haunted hotel, which I looked into many years ago and found that the myth and the legend of the hotel were fabricated for tourism's sake. The acquaintance who sent me the message was Harold Ratcliffe, an entomologist who had amassed quite a collection of bugs and insects from all over the world. I had not heard directly from him in many years, so when I received such an odd message, I thought it best to take a road trip. I did not want to impose on him, but the message insisted I stay with him and, in his own words, deal with a matter of extreme urgency. This, too, was an unusual request because our mutual association at best was distant friends, hardly best mates. I was curious, so I accepted his invitation and set off for Cornwall. Harold didn't live in the village. He lived in an attractive two-story Victorian villa overlooking the sea. He had a modest acreage, but when I rolled up to it, I took note of how well it was groomed. It was very tidy, with stunning, uninterrupted views of the estuary. It was a commanding presence where it stood. I approached the house, and the front door immediately swung open. There stood a haggard Harold Ratcliffe, who did not properly greet me. Rather, he asked, "Did anyone see you drive in?" "To the best of my recollection," I said, "I don't believe so," and he proceeded to show me in. His home was all about his work. He had insect murals on the wall, bug statues and art pieces, even some odd lamps or two where the bases were of invertebrate nature. I decided to get right down to business. "May I ask, respectfully, why have you called for me? Not that I'm not flattered by the invitation, but I found some of the wording in your message hard to interpret and troubling." Harold offered me a seat and sat across from me, leaning in, hands clasped tightly together. I noticed a tenseness in his jaw, and his legs slightly shook like a flea-ridden dog. I've lost control of my work. It's gotten away from me, and I may have opened a door that I'm unable to close. Some months ago, I was running a series of tests on some specimens, the parasite transmitted by a triatomine bug. I wanted to find out why exactly these nocturnal bugs bite around the mouth area while people sleep, and I had planned on looking into Chagas disease. However, my research was interrupted by a devilish thing. I thought I'd seen something from the corner of my eye, but when I turned, it was no longer there. On that particular evening, the perpetual manifestation occurred, and each time with the same result. I was unable to bring the black anomaly into full view. I stopped him there and said, "This sounds very similar to an event that happened to me some years ago. At this time, I carried on my person two stones for divine light called the Urim and the Thummim, two onyx stones, grimoires, but in the end, I used a special camera to end my suffering." He seemed disinterested and continued, "There's more, much more. I believe this is beyond our world," Harold said with a slight tremble added to his nervous leg shake. "Please do continue," I urged him. I wanted to get to the bottom of this. Something dark had interrupted Harold's existence, and for him to have reached out to me must have been a last resort born out of desperation.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish, or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
An official message from Medicare.
A new law is helping me save more money on prescription drug costs. Maybe you can save too. With Medicare's Extra Help program, my premium is zero and my out-of-pocket costs are low. Who should apply? Single people making less than $23,000 a year or married couples who make less than $31,000 a year. Even if you don't think you qualify, it pays to find out. Go to ssa.gov/extrahelp.
Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
I was actually down by the sea. I take walks to clear my head, and studying parasites can be an eye strain under the microscope. The very thing that had taunted me, that dark figure I saw in the corner of my eye, was standing straight ahead on the beach in a hellish gore, dripping with seaweed as if it had just taken a swim. I froze in my tracks. It was not my imagination. This was real. The probability that an otherworldly malignancy had entered our world and at Cornwall, of all places. Well, what are the odds? Astronomical, he stated, using a hypophora. I asked, was the dark thing standing like a man? It was cloaked, not revealing its true form, he answered. Unquestionably, this was proof that I was not going mad and that this thing existed. My fears were insurmountable, and with reluctance, I moved not a muscle because I wanted to know more. I was compelled to take a couple of steps backwards, but I stood my ground. I had not believed in omens. The idea of a portent of good or evil seldom crossed my mind, but this thing made me a believer in prophetic proof. I admit I was intimidated, but the temperament of the thing could not be measured. All of my superstitions came to fruition. Evidently, I had suppressed many childhood fears, and clearly, they had returned to paralyze me where I stood. The thing then dropped its infernal cloak, which was not a garment at all. It was a malefic, perverse shadow. This is when I saw the white, cataractous eyes which glowed with wickedness. This imposing man-sized arthropod, contorted in the most demoniacal spasm and shape. I saw it for what it was. It was a human-sized Zophorus, otherwise known as the ironclad beetle. It was, with due restraint, that my feet did not carry me home right away, but I remained most curious. A couple of inaccuracies struck me, other than the size of the armored bug. Astonishingly, these beetles are found in California, but never in England. Also, this one was standing upright, which is abnormal. Normally, only about an inch long and nearly indestructible, this enhanced bug standing before me, with its unsurpassed exoskeleton and its refined jigsaw puzzle-like shell, was an unrivaled, indestructible war machine. It was profanely reprehensible, a mockery toward nature, but at the same time, it was glorious. I stood amazed by its partially clad underbelly and fibrous, sinewed limbs. Muscle to bone and bone to bone, it resonated with power and strength. I used up the last ounce of my tenacity, attempting to remain composed, but I could not bear to view the ghoulish cyclopean any longer. So I ran for my life, blundering away under unsteady legs, believing I was in harm's way. By the time I'd made it home, I was thoroughly exhausted, desperately panicked and baffled that something like this could exist. Within moments of arriving, completely expended of energy, I practically collapsed through the door. I unceremoniously and quickly locked it and barricaded myself in the bathroom. Why I chose the bathroom is beyond me, but I felt safe. Maybe because it was like putting more walls between me and that flightless beetle. In the bathroom, crouched down, the chattering outside started, which I knew was the chthonic monster clicking its mandibles and hissing loudly. There were many sounds invading my home. It was horrendous. Thereupon, Harold stopped describing his traumatic event and looked to me as if he believed I held the answers. I had no answer, but I had a plethora of questions. What unusual or questionable experiments were you performing right before you encountered this behemoth of a beetle? I am ashamed to profess, moreover, confess to certain questionable practices that I've indulged in subsequent days. You know the reputation of our town and the association with witches and the occult, I presume. I answered, of course, this is England's Salem. We have, of course, the Museum of Witchcraft here, and I know the curator well. He indulged me upon request, and I was permitted to delve into an edition of Demonology from the King James section, and within it I became associated with incantations, omens, and familiar spirits. I know I should have never given myself to such hellish temptation, but my work had stalled. It was by researching the cytoplasm of various animals that I discovered a connection between terrestrial arthropods and alien supernatural characters. Science had dismissed demons many years ago, mainly due to Louis Pasteur finding that germs were responsible for such conditions like rabies, and thus sniffing out the quintessential reasoning for rabies, which people believed at the time to be demon possession. One does not inherit such a virus as rabies, which attacks the brain and nervous system, but can they pass down a demon? Even today, medicine is primitive and diseases are treated rather than cured. I'm convinced these familiar spirits are partially responsible in matters of disease and madness. I see the two inextricably interwoven, and this led me back to my studies on Chagas disease. Where are the dwelling places of these demons, these parasites, when they're not inflicting dread upon their victims? I believe that before the Anglo-Saxons took all of the lands from the indigenous people, spirits were not maleficent like we see today. Spirits, according to some tribes, lived in trees or rivers and were benevolent as long as they were not provoked. Man vexed himself by stirring up the evil that had laid dormant. I've dabbled, and thus I believe I've stirred up a familiar spirit or spirit of insects, and now they've arisen seeking retribution. I am predestined for death. Harold sighed and dropped his head. That was a tempting process, what he had just shared with me, but to be honest, the last I heard anyone saying they were predestined for death was when I infiltrated an Afro-Cuban Yoruba cult a very long time ago, and this spirit, Biku, went after children. This deity of death proved to be a legend only. Harold was truly confused in his evaluations and now believed himself imprisoned, as is written by the ancient Hebrews. They lay in their own houses, prisoners of darkness, fettered in bonds of a long night. I responded with, "I do not see the correlation." Harold seemed offended. He lifted his head, drew a deep breath, and said, sententiously, "They must invariably be connected. These demons, or contagions, devour the humanity within a host. It's a total embodiment of the soul at a certain point, and this is when the body becomes incurable," Harold passionately expressed. "Tonight, we'll return to the sea where you saw this beetle, and let us see if it manifests again," I suggested. A look of pale terror came upon Harold's face, as if all of the blood had left his body. He was truly afraid. His disinclination was obvious. I could see he struggled with his mannerisms, his thoughts, and the notion of returning to the spot he described was intolerable for him. "I'm not looking for validation in my discovery. This thing has plundered my heart. I can still feel it gnawing at me. I need to know how to exterminate it. I've let it out of the box, and I do not know what it is capable of. Beelzebub is the fly guard. He breeds insects by the power of the sun. What if I've invited this entity into our world?" I attempted to conjecture logically, composed, without arrogance or dispute, but I could not disguise my concern. There was a certain truth to be believed in this statement and in his actions, but I needed to see for myself if he'd invoked a devilish fiend, and we were now susceptible to formidable swarms of his venomous subjects. "Do you think I'm imagining things?" he tearfully asked me. "I believe you saw something, but I also believe it's possible your imagination could be playing tricks on you. You did say you had hit a roadblock and had sought out means to continue your research, outside of what I would consider set parameters for your work and studies. Maybe, and I will not say with certainty, but could you be stressed, overworked, and could have experienced a psychotic episode on the night in question?" Decisively, he answered, "No, I saw what I saw, and it was real." "Come, take a look at this," he said, rising from his chair. I followed him outside, weeding our way through the tall grasses until he pointed at the back of his house. "How does one protect himself from that?" he asked. The back exterior wall had been dug into by something sharp and shredding. Part of the wall had calcified in fibrous red cysts, and some were leaking, causing a painted drip effect. The left-hand side of the wall had undefined scattered crimson stains, or maculation. I longed to take a sample back to my own library for analysis, but I had arrived ill-prepared for such clinical work. There was no denying the evidence, and without exception, I swore to him that we would get to the bottom of this. That night, after the sun had melted behind the sea and the night twinkled with dazzling stars, Harold agreed to take me to the exact place of his encounter. He was initially objectionable, but I convinced him that he was the most prevalent character in all of this. I didn't unequivocally believe this to be true. I knew little or nothing about bugs, but I had a wealth of knowledge of demonology. I needed to see the giant insect for myself in order to be absolutely convinced and determine if it was from this world or if it was indeed of extraterrestrial origin. Armed with flashlights for sight and protection, though if this thing was down there by the sea, we were confronted by what he had described, any sort of offense or retaliation would be futile. We walked a fair way until Harold, who was leading, stopped cold. It was right there, where I'm shining my light, he told me. I walked past him because it seemed as though he had no plans of walking further. I shined my light down at the sand and the rocks, but there was no obvious evidence of anything out of place. There's nothing here to find, I informed him with a shout because we were now some distance apart. He said something more or less unintelligible. He looked abstracted. Incidentally, to prove I was taking him seriously, I palpated the sand with my hands, pretending to be looking for something to excavate. Then I saw the sand just out of my reach sifting. It was caving in on itself. Regretfully, I feared I likely had disturbed something sleeping beneath the sand. "We might have something here, Harold," I shouted out bitterly over the sound of the lapping waves. I stood upright from my kneeling position. Many unpleasant-looking worms began to surface in full view. I took a few steps back toward Harold. It was immediately apparent that these worm-like creatures were not a natural occurrence. The worms were wiggling with intent and driving me backward. Harold began his staggered retreat, twisting around to look back a couple of times as he increased his stride. The squirming marine monsters had small crinoid limbs spread along their snakish underbellies, helping to propel them along, and were moving at a fast crawl with every flex of the muscle, sliding and slipping through the sand. I believe these were the feared bobbit worm. These creatures were springing forward, lurching from the sand like coiled springs, snapping their ferocious mouths with chomping sounds, ready to devour flesh down to the tooth-studded throats. Those throats, which sickeningly turned inside out in protraction and retraction movements, aimed toward their prey, which so happened to be the two of us. I had known these to be underwater creatures, not adaptable to land pursuits. However, everything I had ever learned about them I seemed to have been mistaken about, because we were being pursued at a rapid rate in their attempts to girdle either of us in a python grip. I threw out all conceptions of what was known to me for the time being and acted on pure intuition. These benthic worms, with their weaponized jaws wider than their own exposed bodies, attempted to sting us over and over again and take us by the ankles. Their slimy bodies were leaving an unpleasant trail of mucus through the sand. They were far more offensive than anything that could be produced by a demon's bowels. They were splitting apart with multiplying rapidity, but thankfully, we were now at Harold's house. We surged inside and slammed the door. Poor Harold made a move for the bathroom, but I wasn't convinced that would stop this invasion if their intention was to enter the house. They could easily breach our defenses. I was perplexed, and nothing was coming to mind to rescue us, if indeed we needed rescuing. Sounds of gelatinous liquid dripped from the roof, smacking heavily on the ground, which meant the worms had now engulfed the home, and secretions were being released through the sebaceous glands of the worms. And then I thought, the answer's in the book. Harold! I yelled through the bathroom door, where Harold was shaking like a leaf on a tree. Where's the book? I needed that demon book he had dabbled in. The situation was more than likely caused by the book, so it could be resolved within the book. Harold poked his head out of the bathroom and, with a brief injection of courage, said, I'll get it for you. You'll never find it. Harold, in a mad dash, bolted from the bathroom like the house was on fire and disappeared into one of the back rooms. I could hear corpulent globs of gunk now rolling off the roof of the house, the gelled lumps splattering on the ground outside. I hoped the roof would hold up under the writhing pressure. Harold returned, holding the book close to his chest inseparably. I snatched it from him with no time to spare. I was not familiar with the book, so it would be like a needle in a haystack. Then I found exactly what I was looking for on page 43. I read from the book. This was a two-person conversation of one Philomathus and Epistemon, neither of which I was familiar with. Philomathus. Yes, there are sun-dried spirits that affirm to have haunted such places. where these spirits are alleged to be, and could never hear or see anything. Epistemon. I think, well, for that is one lie reserved to the secret knowledge of God, whom he will permit to see such things and whom not. Philomathus. Where these spirits haunt and trouble any houses, what's the best way to banish them? Epistemon. By two means may one lie the remedy of such things be procured. The one is ardent prayer to God, both of these persons that are troubled with them, and of that church whereof they are. The other is the purging of themselves by amendment of life from such sins as have procured that extraordinary plague. Philomathus. And what means, then, these kinds of spirits, when they appeared in the shadow of a person newly dead, or to die, to his friends? Harold screamed out, "What does it mean?" To be honest, it sounded to me like a simple repentance of practicing witchcraft. But I wondered if Harold even knew what he had already done. He seemed oblivious to the magnitude of spiritual crimes he had made committed. There's nothing I could do. This was the first time in my many years of battling the forces of darkness that I had no solution, no backup plan, and felt out of my depth. I was literally unqualified for the undertaking. Dr. Meunier, as he often did at the climax of his stories, paused the stories and asked us in attendance, "Would you care for a bite to eat? A different drink? Anything?" The four of us were always anxious for him to get on with the telling of the story, and we politely informed him that we were fine and set for the night, if he would please continue. "Very well," he mused. "Where was I?" Roger reminded him, "You found the book and had no solution." "That is it," the doctor confirmed, and being reestablished in place, he started again to share his story. Harold was terribly frantic and was pacing the floor, and his hands were fidgety. He had good reason to be worried because the unimaginable was upon us. The inner walls were showing stress cracks from the sheer weight of the frothing, ever-expanding ooze we could see spilling down the windows. Harold bent at the waist, his stomach clenched in sickness, and his face looked bloated as if he were going to burst. The noises of slithering, then constricting in stickiness, causing snaps, slurps, pops, and sucking, filled our ears. I could not be sure the radius that had been affected around the house, but indisputably, the house simply was not going to hold this weight. "Harold, are you a praying man?" I asked, because in situations such as this, prayer maybe should have been the first resort instead of the last. "No, I'm afraid my skills of reaching a divine being are underdeveloped." "I suggest you find your spirit, inner self, because you're the only one who can appease our attackers." Harold seemed to be withering quickly, and in his state of confusion and mental anguish, he plainly said, "God help us." That was not really helpful, and of no use or consolation, and if we were not about to meet our devise, it would have been comical. But under this dire circumstance, I found nothing humorous in his pathetic cry. This was when I noticed that small, creeping things with pincers clacking had burst through an air vent in the ceiling, and it began to rain down saffron-colored, hand-sized crustaceans with yellow, annular-shaped markings on their shelled backs. These were of no invertebrate animal that I could specify. The tips of their pinchers were vibrant green, almost translucent, like a luminance that flickered from a light bulb, not in the socket completely. Their mouths, as best as I could see, protruded from their head and were filled with a copious amount of razor teeth. There was a violent, ciliated orbit, which I can only describe as a rudimentary cyclopean eye, placed in the center of their heads. Harold ran toward me, and using me cowardly as a shield to make distance between him and the scampering aquatic arthropods. As much as his lily-livered antics indisputably and unashamedly were exposed, I cannot say I blame the man. He had no fight in him, and it was looking as though the two of us were about to be ran over. Quickly thinking, I swung open the door to the broom closet, and luckily there was a broom standing in the corner. I commandeered it, the broom, with my right hand and shut the door with my left. I thought, possibly, if I could use the broom to push back the invaders while making a dash for the back door, we stood a chance. In an act of exhilarating desperation, I began sweeping the room back and forth across the floor, pushing the attackers to one side, then the other. Some attached themselves to the bristles of the broom and attempted to make a climb upward along the handle to reach my hands. Even though their pinchers clicked together to hold on, I was surprised to find that the manufactured nightmarish crayfish with their crusher claws were no match for the power of the broom. Once we reached the door, the time for caution and hesitation was over. I opened the door with deliberate force, and together, the two of us charged out into the night, immediately stepping in wet, pasty puddles of mucilaginous adhesive. Whatever the substance was, incredibly, it covered the entire backyard, creating a soggy, oily, spongy sprint, squishing all the way to the main road that led into town. Our shoes were very slippery, and each step we took had to be thought through. The iridescent gunk clung to the soles of our shoes, and we tried to shake off the gloppy mess. The bottoms of our long pants were smeared with the caked on, quickly hardening liquid marrow. Standing at a distance from Harold's home, we could now see the full scale of the globular attack. His house gleamed under moonlight, encased entirely now with a thick, jelly-like substance. As far as demon creatures, I did not see any. I could only imagine the house was crawling with the cold-blooded monsters. As much as I would like to announce our plight was over and we were safe, the unexpected happened. The glittering, frostily tiled roof of Harold's house caved in, and the rest of the house followed, collapsing in on itself, destroying not only his life of work, but burying the demonology in the rubble. Harold groaned with vociferated curses. His loss was the least of our worries, though. I observed something disturbing. There was a shuffling taking place amidst the pile of wood and lumber. Although I believed we were at the safe distance, I could plainly see a mounting collection of legless white larvae emerging from the destruction, rolling off the pile of heap onto the ground. They began to crawl like a clumsy army, but the closer they advanced, they indelibly transformed under the Stygian sky, advancing with hideous mutations, changing their shapes. The greater they metamorphosized from their grub state, the more I could see a new manifestation of winged fire ants. The alteration to their genetic structure was fascinating to watch and aroused me in a great interest, but the unfathomable lengths to which this plague had grown was the real issue at hand. Harold did not have time to wallow in self-pity and bode over his diminishments. He should have been wrapped by the hysteria building in me and the reproductive flight that was taking shape. I had certainly had enough and was ready to bolt for town on foot. There must have been thousands of festering ants, as if a nest had exploded and mobilized from a colony into a potential swarm. Now would be a good time for a giant can of fly spray, I said. The ants were not the average biting kind. These had hornet-style stingers, and I understood they were coming for us. Harold collapsed in his weakness, and I could not pry him from the ground. He was beside himself, floundering mentally, with unaccountable grief and crying out, "Forgive me, forgive me! I'm sorry, I was wrong!" He was wholly engrossed in fear and spoke of terrible hypotheticals out loud of our impending doom. He imagined the seven vials of wrath from the Book of Revelation, Armageddon and killer angels, and speculated upon the apocalypse, abstracted from the environment he was now facing. I could not make sense of him. This was a prayer or a pusillanimous plea from insect mercy. Regardless, my eyes were riveted upon the scourge with intense scrutiny. Swarm was collecting itself, preparing for an imminent attack. Their bodies buzzed and flaked thin, scaly layers away, like weightless confetti. The last of their puppy skin had shed, and now they were covered with a light brown layer of filmy glazed membrane. Despite the almost certain fact that hell was soon to be unleashed, my eyes instinctually diverted away when I heard a unique sound of a certain definite vibration that I'd never heard before. I could not begin to imagine what other mortal danger was coming our way. The sky over my shoulder was clotted with what I imagined at first to be dragonflies, but as it moved closer, it was a supersedure larger swarm of praying mantis. The angelic specimens were descending rapidly. Was this another portent? A sign that our demise was close at hand? I could not be sure if this was a good omen or a bad one. Not until they soared right above our heads, straight over us like a ball of fire, with a deafening roar, and engaged the swarm of flying red ants before they were assembled to launch their assault. The praying mantises were a godsend. Maybe the heavens had heard Harold's abysmal petition, but it was neither here nor there because the mantis struck with deadly force and precision. The sky was humming with an ear-splinting buzzing, a cacophony of droning vibrations in a whirring sound of victory and death. Because of the late hour, we saw little of the war that raged, but it didn't take long for the thrumming to filter out, and all was silent except for the distant waves of the sea crashing up on the shore. The doctor's story was over, and we sat in stunned silence. "Well, gentlemen, that's the reason for the praying mantis that I introduced tonight. I now value the mantis as a portent of good news far above any other living creature at the moment. For if they had not gathered to rescue Harold in that hue of fire, and this dark omen had bled itself out and had not been restrained, it could have spread as an infestation, an unstoppable contagion even across England and possibly all of Europe." Peter Blatty, who had remained quiet throughout the story, asked, "What about Harold? What happened to the poor fellow?" The doctor said, "It's reputed that Harold salvaged some of his work and has tried to pick up where he left off in his research, minus the demonology and witchcraft sources he foolishly leaned on. But do not allow me to misrepresent poor Harold. We were met with more than a formidable foe. These will be remembered as endearing formative days in which we both nearly lost our lives. One's demise is hardly a thing to scoff at. Harold survived, as well as I, and we independently used our survival means regardless of how different they may have been. I think in some regards we showed equal doggedness, even as it manifested differently between us." Blank Plantain had remained seated, also quiet until this moment, when he inquired, "As to the demonology, the book that seemed to have been the source of the dread and blight, what became of it?" The doctor slyly smiled and answered with a question, "What becomes of all great artifacts I stumble across in my travels?" We knew what he meant, for Dr. Victor Meunier was a collector of all things weird, strange, and unexplained. I hope you enjoyed The Mantis and the Doctor by Dale Thompson, as performed by yours truly. If you enjoyed the tale and would love to read more from tonight's very talented featured author, you can help support him by visiting simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. That's simplyscarypodcast.com/Dale-Thompson. Thanks again for your support of this program and tonight's featured author. And once again, I'd like to give a nice big thank you to all of tonight's featured authors. Now, before we go, I would also like to take a moment to thank you personally for joining me here on this episode of Scary Stories Told in the Dark. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to us. If you'd like to hear a premium extended edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes featuring Twice the Terror, visit simplyscarypodcast.com today and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen. You'll find yourself at chillingtalesfordarknights.com, where you can purchase season passes for this podcast and our other quality storytelling programs. Or become a patron for as little as $5 a month. Get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, all of it ad-free. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. You can subscribe to me on YouTube as well at the Otis Gyrie channel, where you'll find releases of my series, Horror Storytime, dating back 10 years to 2014. And you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram too. Just search for Otis Gyrie. Until next week, stay spooky and get some sleep, if you can.
Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Scary Stories Told in the Dark, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcasts Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's program was hosted, and its featured stories, performed by yours truly, Otis Gyrie. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Luke Hodgkinson and Jesse Cornett. Sound design and final mixing and mastering provided by executive producer and director Craig Groshek. Program's artwork and logo by David Romero. If you're looking for some fresh tales on a daily basis while waiting for the next podcast, check out my YouTube channel, the Otis Gyrie channel, and my extensive collection of narrated tales there. Simply search on YouTube by my name and you'll find me. And don't forget to subscribe and press the bell notification icon to get my latest releases. Got a scary tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to me today at otis@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your terrifying tome considered for production in a future episode of this show. That's otis@simplyscarypodcast.com. If you've enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, subscribe to us to be sure you never miss an episode and leave a 5-star review and a comment. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on Facebook to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and other programs and my channel. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon for CTFDN as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every Wednesday. And don't forget to hit that thumbs up button to tell us how we're doing and leave a kind word or a request. And don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archive and ad-free downloads of all your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, I'll be back next Wednesday with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. But that's all right. Who needs sleep anyway?
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well. If you own a home, you know how much work it can take, whether it's everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality. It can be hard just to know where to start, but now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's Angie.com.
An official message from Medicare.
A new law is helping me save more money on prescription drug costs. Maybe you can save too. With Medicare's Extra Help program, my premium is zero and my out-of-pocket costs are low. Who should apply? Single people making less than $23,000 a year or married couples who make less than $31,000 a year. Even if you don't think you qualify, it pays to find out. Go to ssa.gov/extrahelp.
Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.